WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
William Maxwell died this week at the age of 91. He was the author of several novels and short story collections and was a fiction editor at The New Yorker from 1936 to 75. Maxwell was born in the small town of Lincoln, Illinois, where he lived until moving to Chicago at the age of 14. Much of his fiction was set in the past, in towns like Lincoln. I spoke with him in 1995 after the publication of a collection of new and old stories called All the Days and Nights. A lot of the stories in your new collection come out of memories of your childhood. How much do you feel that your memory of your past has been your subject as a writer?
I think about three quarters of the time, actually. When I was first beginning to write, I wrote largely out of the present. And was alert for any situation taking place around me that could make a story. But the present, though very pleasant, didn't seem to go very deeply into anything. And memories sit on the back of the stove like soup, and they get richer and richer from the things they attract to them, and their wonderful kind of accidental quality. But I also have a kind of abnormal memory, really. My memories go back, as far as I can make out, to when I was 2 years old. And I have quite vivid memories of what before I was four. And it isn't that I haven't forgotten things, but I have remembered things, more things than people usually do. And in my old age, there's an additional vividness to them, and detail. And the detail is sometimes so astonishing that I feel everything is there. Everything that ever happened to me is there. It's a matter of unhooking it and bringing it out to the light.
Are you saying that your past has become more vivid to you as you've gotten older?
Yes, much more vivid.
Is there anything that would explain that?
I think it's a common phenomenon. But also, I'm 86, there's a breakdown in the sense of the divisions of time between past, present, and future. The future is problematical, and the present is rather meditative because I'm not involved in an active job. And I read and wander around the house and garden and do things that don't interfere with any kind of meditative process. So there's nothing to prevent the accidental memory from getting into your mind. And I do think memories are attached. Something brings them up. They don't usually force their way up like air through water. But I have had a sense of that the past is no longer different from the present. That I can live in the past as I live in the present. I think some part of my life that I enjoyed very much, and I think, well, enjoy it. It's still here. You're in it, even though the people I haven't seen for 30 years.
You know, in the story that we were reading from before, what he was like, one of the characters described himself as being in the age of funerals, or is always going to
yes.
funerals. Have you outlived a lot of your friends?
Yes. I have outlived three very close friends. And I think about them quite often. I've also outlived people of the older generation who were very kind and did wonderful things for me that I think of with love and gratitude.
Some people really say that people who they've loved who have passed are still with them in a way that they never expected. Do you ever feel that way?
Spooks, you mean?
Well, I don't mean like actual ghosts, but just feeling somebody's presence.
Yes. People often speak of it, really. And they speak of it as if they don't entirely rule out the possibility of ghosts. I think there's another way that people are kept, and that is someone who's especially dear to you, so dear that you can't face the idea of never seeing them again. You take on certain of their qualities. My mother was a very outgoing, hospitable, and quite happy woman. And I'm rather introverted and tend to be shy with strangers and like to be alone, like to read. And when she died, I was only a little boy, and I wasn't ready to give her up. And I haven't given her up. I think about her quite often. As I'm older, I remember her face more vividly. But I also am aware that that I have a kind of sociable life. I don't say that it isn't me, but it's the part of me that developed because I took part of her into my nature rather than let her die.
It was a long time ago that she died. It was 1918 or 19.
Immense time ago.
Yeah. You've written about her a lot.
Yes.
So you think you became more sociable?
I think so. Happy with people. Because she was always happy with people.
Losing her when you were, I think it was 10 years old, to the flu epidemic, it must have made you think that at any moment someone who you love could just suddenly disappear. Because people were dying all around during that epidemic. I mean, so many Americans died. Were you always like bracing for that?
After that?
Mm-hmm.
No. My father was a very strong character and a physically strong man. And once when I was a little boy, I was in a boat on the Illinois River with my father and mother, and he was fishing, and we were far out in the middle of the river, and a sudden thunderstorm came up, and there were white caps on the waves, and it was quite a way back to the dock. And my father said to get down to the bottom of the boat. And my mother was a heavy woman, so he had to pull quite a lot to get her in a hurry through the water. However, we stepped out of the boat just as the cloudburst came down. As long as he lived, and I think I have it still, the feeling of being safe because of him, safe because he was an honest man, safe because he was a decent man, and safe because he was physically strong. So, what the effect my mother's death had on me was really that things happen that you don't want to happen, that you can't bear to have happen, and that you must somehow learn that there is no way to get around that fact. So I learned to live with the things that can't be undone.
Well, you know, speaking of things that can't be undone, that leads me to another story in your new collection, and it's a story based on a memory, based on something that happened. The story is called The Holy Terror.
Yes.
And you wrote it in 1985 after the death of your older brother. I'm sorry, you wrote it in 1986 after his death in 1985. I think I have that right.
Close enough.
Yeah, okay. And what happened was when you were very, very young, your brother was trying to... when you were very, very young, your aunt was leaving in a horse and buggy, and your brother, who was a boy, wanted to go with her.
About five.
And he tried to climb up onto the buggy, and what happened?
Well, she didn't know he was there. He climbed at the wheel, and she was talking to my mother. And she finished her sentence and cracked the whip to make the horse move forward, and the wheels turned. And my brother slipped, and his... leg got caught in the wheel, and his leg was broken. And what I was told, I presume by my father, but somehow or other I acquired the information that it was broken in so many pieces that they had to cut it off. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s that an uncle who was a doctor told me that, in fact, it was a simple fracture that not once in 100 times ever required an amputation. But the family doctor was a drug addict, because they used to dispense medicine, so they had access to drugs. And he didn't set the leg properly, and gangrene had set in, and that's why they had to cut it off. But my brother didn't know this, I'm quite sure. And I don't think his family knew it while he was alive.
Well, he never knew that?
No.
Boy, it would have been really hard for him to live with that.
It would have been unbearable. And I managed to keep his secret while we were both alive.
Was it hard for you to keep it a secret?
No, I had no desire. I just had a fear that he might find out, but I knew he wouldn't find out through me.
This is the kind of story I always find really frightening, in the sense that so many people have the kind of lives in which in one moment they made one foolish move that cost them something very dear that they could never get back.
Yes.
Like a leg.
And the leg, the price seems to be so disproportionate to the offense.
But a story like that can paralyze you, can make you feel like, I better not make any move in case I make the wrong move.
I know, but we're animals and we have to move.
What you write in your story was that watching what happened to your brother changed you. You say, I became a more tractable, more even-tempered, milder person than it was in my true nature to be.
I think this is true, but it is not my perception. It was something which was said to me when I was in analysis by the psychoanalyst. He thought that there was a fierce character inside my rather gentle exterior, and that the reason that exterior was so gentle was because the fierce character saw what happens to little. My father, my brother didn't just climb on that wagon. He smoked cigars when he was two or three, and he was, he was hell on wheels.
Right.
Yes.
Really willful.
My father had to lock up his cigar case.
Oh, gosh.
When he was 3 years old. And he turned the hose on the women of the family. He was full of beans. But then look what happened to him. So I think it might have, I can't swear to these things. Who can swear to anything psychological? It might have made me more quiet and gentle and bookish, but perhaps those were just my genes. I don't know. Who knows?
William Maxwell, recorded in 1995. He died Monday at the age of 91. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. We'll close this half hour with music by one of his favorite composers, Robert Schumann, performed by Marta Argerich. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're remembering William Maxwell. He died this week at the age of 91. He was the author of several novels and short story collections, and for nearly 40 years was a fiction editor at The New Yorker. J.D. Salinger, John Cheever, John Updike, and Vladimir Nabokov are some of the writers he edited. Let's continue our 1995 interview with Maxwell. From 1936 to 1975... you were a fiction editor at the New Yorker magazine. And since we're talking so much about memory, maybe you could remember for us a little bit what it was like to be at the New Yorker back in 1936.
It was a wonderful place. I was hired to see artists. That was the technical name for it. And there, at the moment, didn't seem to be any office space, so they put me in a bullpen in a corner facing a drawing on the wall by Thurber of himself. But it was outside Mrs. White's office, and so I heard quite a lot that went on in the office. And she was a rather stately woman, very handsome and very stately, and when private matters were being discussed, she would get up from her desk in a stately fashion and walk to the doorstop and release it, and then between the time it took a rather slow door to close, I heard quite a lot. Anyway, she hired me. And Catherine White and Evie White and Wilkett Gibbs and Ross and Thurber, all half a generation older than I was. And I never felt that I was responsible for the making of the magazine. But I admired them. I also had reservations because I was already a novelist when I got there, and I read enormously, and I saw that there were certain areas that they were unwilling to touch.
Like what?
Well, it was astonishing now. They've long since got over that inhibition, but they wouldn't publish a story that involved the Jewish question. They wouldn't involve a story that involved homosexuality. There were several things that they felt simply inappropriate, which was formed a kind of straitjacket. Eventually, of course, everything and every kind of language has crept into the New Yorker, but this is the way it was when I went to work there.
As a fiction editor at the New Yorker, was it your responsibility to carry out certain parameters of discretion, you know, to respect certain parameters of discretion, so to speak, that you didn't really respect yourself?
I didn't have to carry them out. I just had to submit to them. For example, there was a John Cheever story which had the sentence in it, Coverley, with love in his heart and lust in his trousers, walked across the lawn. And the editor at that time, William Shawn, said it couldn't be published. I thought it could be published. I didn't see why it couldn't be published. I thought it was a wonderful sentence, but it didn't get published.
Shawn won.
Shawn won.
Of course, I suppose.
Yes. Yes. He had all the cards, but I think Wright was on my side.
So what was that exchange with Shawn like? Were you in his office talking with him? Was this a back and forth on paper that happened?
It was in his office. He put it in on a when the manuscript came back, he said it should be cut. And so I went to his office to explain didn't think it should be cut. And I thought it was a good sentence. So he said it shouldn't, and I said it should stay in the story. And he said it shouldn't. So I just gave up and walked out of the office. What more could I do? I knew him well enough to know he wasn't going to change his mind.
And what did Cheever have to say about it?
I think I told John and apologized, but that's all. He had many grievances against the New Yorker, but that doesn't seem to have been one of them.
Did you feel like a New Yorker working at the New Yorker? You were from a small town in Illinois.
When I first went to work, I felt very different from them. At that particular moment, three plays of Noel Coward had just opened with Gertrude Lawrence, and there was a great deal of conversation about going to the opening nights, and I didn't go to opening nights. I'd never seen a Noel Coward play. I felt from the hinterlands. And in a sense, I remained from the hinterlands. But I stopped worrying about it and felt that's who I am, that's where I belong, and what the hinterlands have to offer is something as good as anywhere else. But I don't think I ever became, in any sense, I never felt sophisticated. And they were, rather. But strangely, only in certain areas. In other areas, they weren't. For example, E.B. White he did read Anna Karenina, but it took him 3 years. And he was not a reader at all. The whole vast areas of English and American classics were outside his experience, which isn't sophistication, is it?
Right.
But he's a very, very sophisticated writer.
I think of how much the world has changed since you were a boy, from, you know, horse and buggies to, you know, moonwalks and portable computers and all of that. Do you feel like you still make an effort to keep up with all the big changes, technological and otherwise, or is it not important to you now?
I don't say I make an effort not to keep up, but I certainly don't make any effort to keep up. For example, I use a typewriter, not a computer.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Mitchell, my colleague at the New Yorker, is fond of a Quaker phrase, which is very convenient. When there's something, some current manifestation, he says, it doesn't speak to my condition. And if you're 86, of course, lots of contemporary things don't speak to your condition. Your condition is placed 30, 40, 50, 60 years earlier. I liked the world I came into as a child. My father liked new things. He wanted. He thought all the new inventions were marvelous. And in general, I've tended to hate them. I would so gladly put an end to all flying machines, all automobiles, all mechanical means of locomotion except the horse and buggy. It was a beautiful world. I loved the sound of a horse clop, cloppity clop, clop going past the house. It was unhurried. It left time for brooding and thought. It left time for being nice to other people. It left time for making presents instead of buying them. It left time for telling stories.
I don't know if this is an answerable question or not, but what has given you the most pleasure about getting older, and what has been the most painful or most sad for you about it?
Nothing has been sad, strangely, but it's because the most serious losses haven't occurred. My wife is 13 years younger than I am, and she is still beautiful. She takes wonderful care of me. And so in the center of the operation, things are still secure. I don't mind. When I wrote that story about the man who kept a diary, I did, in fact, look out of the window and see children running down the street and think, how wonderful it would be to run like that. But I've accepted the fact that I'm not going to run like that. And the other day, I went to the theater with a friend, and there were no taxis. It was a matinee, and there were no taxis. And we walked and walked and walked and walked. And finally, as we got close to Grand Central, I saw a stopped taxi with a light on and realized somebody was about to get out of it. And I ran. And I was so happy I could run. I don't say I ran very fast, but I covered the ground and I got there before somebody else did. I love so many things about being old. For one thing, I'm quite charitable about most people and most things, and equally charitable toward my own shortcomings. And it makes for a pleasant state of mind. I love reading, and you can read. My eyesight's still fine. And I love gardening, and my knees are able to kneel on. And so the wonderful opening out of memory, the wonderful fact that you look back over such a long period, is like having a marvelous novel. And my health is on the whole fine. So I think old age is a minefield, but I've only stepped on one or two mines during that period.
So interesting to hear you talk about this. I feel like we get such mixed messages about aging. On the one hand, we all want to live a long time.
Yes, it is curious, isn't it?
And on the other hand, older people are always saying, whatever you do, don't get old.
No, I don't feel that way. I wouldn't have missed it for anything.
William Maxwell recorded in 1995 after the publication of a short story collection, All the Days and Nights. Maxwell died Monday at the age of 91. We'll hear more from a writer he mentored, Alec Wilkinson, after a break. This is Fresh Air.